The last case is Martin versus Pierce County, 21-35251. We don't have both of you yet. Maybe I'm assuming opposing counsel is going to appear by video and not by audio. We should have both of them? Okay, we don't yet, so. We'll go off record for just a moment. Oh, wait, there he is. Great. Okay, I can see two lawyers now. I hope you're the right ones. Are you both here for Martin versus Pierce County?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, that's
yes, great. Your Honor.
Thank you very much. And you can both hear us, I hope.
Okay. Speaking for myself, I can hear you quite well. I hope you can hear myself.
Okay.
And I can hear you well as well.
Great. I'll try to stay out of your way, but let me just tell you that our connection today, we can hear everybody just fine. You're certainly loud enough, but there's a little bit of a delay, or it's just a little bit muddy. So if you speak a bit slower than normal, I think you'll help us out.
Okay.
Whenever you're ready, we are ready to hear your argument.
Okay. I'm sorry, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Barty Martin of Boyle Martin Taney. I represent the appellant in this matter, Jeffrey Martin. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. And I would like to use my time to address a few of the issues raised in the brief and answer any questions you may have. First off, I would like to address that this is a procedural statute. The statute at issue is procedural and not substantive. This is shown first in the legislative intent, as the title that they chose to name the title of the statute, election to submit to arbitration procedure. So they include procedure in the statute. Washington courts have analyzed similar statutes as addressed at length in the briefing, and found those medical negligence statutes also were procedural, including the certificate of merit statute and the mandatory mediation statute, the revision that took place in 2007. The statute itself does not create any new right to relief. It simply creates a procedural mechanism to initiate arbitration, in addition to mechanisms that were already present. Both in state and federal courts, arbitration is available to the litigants. It was prior to that, as a procedural statute. It should not be enforced in federal courts as a state's procedural statute.
Counsel, the question about what's procedural and what's not gets a little muddy sometimes, certainly under Erie. Mm-hmm. Don't we start with Shady Grove to try to figure out whether there's a conflict between the state statute and the federal rule?
Yes, and as outlined again in the briefs, there is.
Okay, so here's what I'm trying to figure out. May I ask you this? Forgive me for interrupting, but I want
yes.
to ask my question and try stay out of your way so you can answer it. I think the district court decided that there was a conflict between the state provision that we're talking about, not the other two that have already been construed. This one has not been construed. I think he decided there was a conflict between it and state civil rule 3. I'm trying to figure out why there would be a conflict with state civil rule 3 and not a conflict with federal civil rule 3.
Well, Your Honor, that is our position, that there is a conflict with Rule 3, both the federal state Rule 3, the federal and state Rule 8, and the federal and state Rule 11.
Are you familiar with Judge Easterbrook's opinion in the Young case, for the Seventh Circuit case?
I am not, Your Honor.
It's a case where It's a case where he said it sort of depends on what you're doing with this. It could be substantive or could be procedural. And it really turned in the Seventh Circuit on when the case was dismissed. And he said there's a conflict with Rule 8 because a statute that requires you to file something else with the complaint, at the time of the complaint, presents a conflict. But at the summary judgment stage, that's a substantive ruling. The state could come in at that point and say you haven't got enough, you haven't filed the correct certification. So this case, I just want to be sure, we're talking about a 12B6 ruling, yes?
That is correct.
All right. And your position is that it conflicts with 3, 8, and 11?
It does. The first, if you don't mind, I'll address Rule 11. In both state and federal, in the state and federal rule, they both provide that there doesn't need to be additional in pleadings. They don't need to be accompanied by an affidavit, any kind of sworn affidavit. Within state courts, there's an exception for family law. Some family law pleadings require it. And in the federal law, obviously, if there is a federal law that requires it, it makes allowance for that. This is a state statute that does not qualify as a law under the federal rule 11A.
Counsel, can I just push back on that a bit? Because Rule 11 talks about you don't have to file a verified complaint. Right, you don't have to file anything to verify the authenticity of the facts alleged, in other words, is my rough shorthand of that. And this declaration that we're talking about here under the Washington statute that ends with, I'd be calling it 020, is a very different kind of a declaration pertaining to arbitration. So I don't see a strong Rule 11 argument for you. Do you want to respond?
Well, the plain language of that rule is, unless a rule or statute specifically states otherwise, a pleading need not be verified or accompanied by an affidavit. That I speaks for itself to a certain degree.
There's a number of courts that have come down your way, but they seem to be relying on Rule 8.
And Rule 8, we made that argument for Rule 8 as well.
What's your strongest argument, 3, 8, or 11?
Well, I think that's ultimately up for the three of you to decide. But I think that that they both are relatively strong. Rule 8 requires short, plain statement of the court's basis for jurisdiction. Plain statement of the claim and the demand for relief, essentially. This adds an additional element necessary or an additional requisite necessary to file a complaint. So certainly that collides directly with what Rule 8 lays out.
Do I have the decision tree correct that if we don't find a conflict, if we're not persuaded by your arguments about Rule 3, 8, or 11, then we look to an Erie analysis to figure out whether this Washington statute is substantive?
Yes. Well, I think that if you can find first that it is procedural, that you would not need to go there. I essentially I agree with you.
Okay.
The district court held that the content of Rule 8 was exclusive and you couldn't add anything, citing an 11th Circuit case and a Scalia treatise. Is that position just wrong?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm having a little difficulty hearing.
The district court indicated that Rule 8 is exclusive. All that is required for a pleading is the elements in Rule 8, citing an 11th Circuit case and a Scalia treatise going to maxims of interpretation. Is the district court just wrong on that?
Your Honor, I apologize, but if I could come back to that after my break and review
Certainly.
I don't have an answer for you right now.
Doesn't look like we have any additional questions at this point.
Okay. Well, if that's the case, I'm happy to turn it your time over to opposing counsel. Okay.
We'll hear from opposing counsel next.
Good morning. May it please the court, Ross Taylor, representing the appellees, NAFCARE, Inc., nurse practitioner Arena Hughes, and nurse Janelle French. I'll state up front, I do have a tendency to get hurried, so if I am cutting out, please let me know. We are asking the court to affirm District Court Judge Benjamin Settle's partial order of dismissal disposing of the state malpractice allegations in response to the undisputed failure to comply with Washington's substantive law. There are four reasons that the ruling should be affirmed. First, the plain text, and Your Honor, I heard you refer to it as 020 for short. I think for today I'll just call it the law for clarity. But it's plain and ambiguous. It commands very simply that a claimant must do a very simple thing, elect or decline arbitration. Here, he did not. I don't believe that this law is vague or incomplete. It is a substantive law that must be enforced at the federal level, and that this court should advise making any sort of advisory ruling about potential conflicts with any state rules.
Go right ahead.
Counsel, let's start there. So the Washington revised the Washington statute at issue here 7.70A.020 in 2A uses the term commencing. And the term commencing is also used in Rule 3 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And it tells us how a suit in federal court is commenced. So it's by filing a complaint. And then Rule 8 tells us things that the complaint must have, and sort of by negative implication, it suggests that there are other things that the complaint does not have to have, anything else. So how do we reconcile this when Washington is telling us, in order to commence a suit, you must do X, and that seems to be different from what's required under the federal rules?
And I think it's, instead of adding or changing what the definition of commencement is under Rule 3, it just uses that as kind of a bookmark in time. It's saying that at the time of commencement, this is what must be done. It doesn't change the definition. And in that sense, I think, although the Waples...
Well, it may not be directly conflicting with Rule 3, but if you read Rule 3 and Rule 8 together, it does seem to be inconsistent. So let's suppose that the Washington statute said anybody who's filing a complaint in tort must file an affidavit notarized that says it's done in good faith, and that's all it is. It's just a good faith certification. Doesn't require outside experts or doctors or anybody else to look at the complaint. But it's just a notarized. Now, does that move over to federal court?
Well, there, I think you do have a problem, because that is creating something that would be, I would think that would be more in direct conflict with CR 11. But again, that's not what this law provides. It simply provides that the parties have been advised.
Well, it requires some kind of a certification. I've just changed the nature of the certification.
Yes, but I think that the degree of certification and what is being certified is significant. And so, for example, as you referenced, even in the cases where it's asking for a certification from an expert or that there will be future evidentiary support, those are the types of provisions that have been struck down. And we're not arguing that those were incorrectly struck down. What we are saying is that this is a provision that does not have any bearing, that's outside or inconsistent or cannot be harmonized and coexist. I think coexist peacefully is the language, with the federal rules.
What, are you familiar with the Seventh Circuit's decision in Young?
I guess no, I'm not.
It's not. I'm not trying to trip either one of you up with this question, but it's just that most courts that have found a conflict have found a conflict, I think, with Rule 8. And certainly some with Rule 3. I've certainly telegraphed that I've got a Rule 3 question, but I'm not particularly bothered by Rule 11. But what about Rule 8? How do you get around Rule 8?
Well, I think that Judge Settle actually addressed that quite well. I think his language is, and I'm paraphrasing here somewhat, but he assessed that this law does not bear on stating a claim, so it doesn't implicate or offend CR 8. You're not making any sort of statement about the nature of...
I'm not sure I understand that.
Sure. So I think that if this had to do with the types of, and again, drawing parallels to the cases or laws that were overturned, if it has to do with saying, there will be more evidentiary support for this, or I have this expert saying that I believe there is currently or will be evidentiary support, then that's going directly towards stating a claim. It's going towards the elements that you're seeking out to prove.
Right, but counsel, as you know, Rule 8 says you need a short, plain statement. It says exactly what you need at the time of filing, not at the summary judgment stage. You know, where at the time of filing, we're talking about a 12B6, and this adds something else to that. How is that not a conflict?
Because I think that Rule 8 leaves open that there can be other things added to that, and I'm saying that I think it would be problematic if you were saying that something needed to be added to it that was above and beyond what Rule 8 commands. So if you're saying that you needed more than a short, plain statement of the grounds for jurisdiction or more than stating that you're entitled to relief, then you would have problems, as was done in Putnam and Waples, and really was done with Certificate of Merit statutes across the nation.
So you're pushing back against Judge Bybee's proposition that in Rule A, where it says, here's what you need, you know, and it lists short, plain statement, his proposition was that the implied is that you don't need anything else.
Yes, I think that it leaves open that you can have requirements for something else as long as it's not inconsistent with what is being commanded. Which is to say, I don't think that is an exhaustive list, especially as long as it doesn't implicate. Now, that leaves a very narrow territory of things that could be required that wouldn't offend those statements. But here, I think that this falls into, it's seeking out to encourage an appropriate legislative goal of encouraging arbitration, and that can really only be done if there is strict enforcement of it and mandatory language. Otherwise, it could just, essentially, it's just there for show. So here, being able to do that, I think makes it consistent with...
But I think you might be talking me out of Rule 11 and thinking that that is weak, because to circle back to Judge Bybee's point, he's just changed the nature of what the declaration is, what the affidavit is that has to be filed at the time. So why isn't that a conflict?
Again, because I think it's the nature of what's being represented.
Okay.
So, counsel, let's suppose that the Washington statute said, before commencing a lawsuit, the parties must go to mediation. And therefore, as a part of the suit, you're going to have to file some kind of a certification that mediation failed. Is that effective in federal court?
No, again, and I don't think that would be, because you're clearly then implicating, I guess, really all three of those rules, including when the suit is commenced, or adding actions that must be done. And this is, again, similar to the Waples decision, addressed something that's saying that you had to give 90 days notice to the defendant.
So what's the difference in degree between Washington saying, before commencing a suit, you must do X, and therefore we need some kind of certification at the time of commencement in order not to suffer a motion to dismiss? And Washington saying, at the time of commencement, you must indicate, you know, that you're not willing to arbitrate.
And again, because I think that that's not, the distinction for me is, if you're saying forced mediation beforehand, and just simply I've been advised of the option, I think that that's a significantly different degree of action or really compulsion of what's being required. And I think that I guess it would depend on how this, and I'm not trying to say this as a cop-out, but I suppose it would depend on how the statute is phrased.
Let me give you a different hypo. So okay. Washington says, at the time of commencing a tort suit, the parties must also file a certification stating whether they are willing to submit to mediation. So it's future-looking instead of backwards-looking. Now, does that
mean
the federal court?
I think that would be permissible, just as the statute before this.
It would be permissible.
Unless I'm misunderstanding the question, yes, I believe so.
So if you went into federal court, you would now have to file a certification in federal court stating whether you were willing to submit to mediation. And if you don't file it, then presumably your suit is subject to dismissal?
If the language is that something that must, quote, must be done, then yes.
How does that not conflict with the federal rules of civil procedure?
I guess I don't see how it does conflict. You're making a statement on something outside of your grounds for jurisdiction, outside your grounds for relief and your demand for relief sought.
That would be Washington now dictating how the federal courts will conduct lawsuits commenced in federal court. That is, the federal courts are now going to have to provide some mechanism for getting things to mediation.
Well, I think if I was understanding your question correctly, it's that the parties would pursue the mediation, and then it's the same as enforcing the bounds to any other pendant jurisdiction claim. That the federal courts are going to enforce it in the same manner that the Washington courts would be enforcing it.
Anything further?
I'm sorry, did that address your question?
I'm not sure it answered it to my satisfaction, but you were responsive, counsel. Thank you for that.
Okay. I guess just briefly, I do want to tackle something that was raised, I think, in Mr. Martin's reply brief, simply that the law is vague or incomplete, and also this idea that the title of the chapter is somehow persuasive. I think the court is correct that the term used was muddy. The assessment of procedural versus substantive law assessment is muddy, and I don't think that the title of the statute has any real bearing on that sort of analysis. But even further, counsel or in briefing at that in the reply brief made new arguments that this law was incomplete or vague, citing to some authority, basically saying that you should look to because the law does not specify the sanction, that there really can't be a sanction. And I guess I would disagree with that. I think that it's axiomatic, two things. One, that an exercise of statutory interpretation begins with plain text. Here, the language is must. I don't believe that it needs really much parsing. And two, you're
losing me a little bit here. Can I just, are you speaking to the argument in the reply brief, which may have been raised, I think, for the first time in the reply brief, that the remedy here is dismissal? And I think the argument in the reply brief is that it need not be dismissed. Is that what you're speaking to?
Yes, and that is what I'm trying to speak to. And I think what it was... It was raised for the first time on the reply brief, which is why I wanted to address it here, because it's kind of my only opportunity. But the idea being that because other portions of the law said the remedy is dismissal, that because this law doesn't say dismissal, then that's somehow fatally defective. And I guess I would just fundamentally disagree with that, because the term must is the same as the term shall. It says that something has to be done. So given the plain language, and I think that also it's also axiomatic in statutory interpretation that you have to avoid a result that would render a provision meaningless. And if there is no enforcement mechanism to the statute, then it is effectively meaningless, which I think comes to another argument that was made, and I think bears a little bit of discussion here today, is this suggestion that because the defendants weren't, in Mr. Martin's view, strictly complying with the statute, then that must mean that his strict compliance should also be or should be overlooked. And I would raise three points there. So first, that the defendant's compliance or not with the statute is not at issue on appeal, just isn't there. But second, and I think more importantly, the law sets up a dual consent scenario for arbitration. The claimant either elects or declines at commencement, and then in response, at the time of answering, a defendant elects or declines, which is why the timing is important and mandated and specified in the law. So here, the defendants did what was really kind of the best option available in light of non-compliance from the claimant, move for dismissal. Because that dismissal was pending for some time and it was only partial dismissal, they did eventually have to answer and specifically called out in their answer that Mr. Martin had not complied with the statute and they were reserving rights. And I want to put forth just to the court the reason that that's done. have one other case right now where the claimant did not comply with this statute. When it was raised on dismissal, they voluntarily non-suited the case and refiled. So that's why the reservation on answering is important, because you're sitting there saying, in the event this case is either dismissed or refiled or comes back around, then the defendant will be in a position to be properly informed and respond to whether or not this dual consent can be satisfied for that. I also want to address the point, and I think that this ties into what I was just saying about the statute not being vague. Mr. Martin seems to fault that there was not language specifying what the sanctions would be. And if it were just, sorry, I realize that I just went over time. I'll be very, very brief here. I think that it leaves open that the lack of specifying sanctions leaves it open to the court, depending on who the party is. If it's claimant, it's dismissal. If it's defendant, it could be any number of things, including fees and costs, forced arbitration, so on and so forth. Thank you, court, for the time, and again, ask that the decision be affirmed.
Thank you for your argument. Opposing counsel, you have a few minutes. You have 6 minutes left on the clock, quite a bit of time.
Mr. Martin, I think I misled you
with my question. Attributing that analysis to the district court. It was rather one of the circuit court decisions, but I take it you agree that, that Rule 8 is exclusive.
Yes, Your Honor. I do. I think that it excludes other requirements, especially state requirements, pleading requirements on commencement or in the complaint.
Could I just push back on that? Because
yes.
We've been reminded painfully for several years now about Iqbal, about Twombly, about it's not just notice pleading. There needs to be significantly more. So I don't know if that's what Judge Selna is getting at, but I have circles in places in your brief where I think you take a very hard line position about what is needed, what is called for by Rule 8. And so maybe I'm reading too much into your answer, but could you enlighten us, please?
Well, I'm not going to argue that the developments in pleading requirements are wrong. I do think that the definition of a brief statement of facts is entirely different from, it's sort of an expansion on what that means. That's much different than requiring a plaintiff in a medical negligence claim with a medical negligence claim to add a declaration on top of what's required by the rule.
Judge Selma, did I hijack your question?
No.
We may have been going at this in a different way.
No.
All right. Anything further?
Yes, I would just like to point out, first off, that there is no the appellee seems to want it two ways: strict compliance for one party, the plaintiff, and not strict compliance for the other. It is the ultimate sanction that he's arguing for, but it's not something that should be imposed on a defendant in this case. My strict compliance arguments may have been raised in the reply for the first time, but they were also in response to his answering brief. The statute 020 was passed at the same time as the Certificate of Merit statute, which was invalidated by the Washington Supreme Court. That statute specifically allowed for dismissal if there were for noncompliance on the plaintiff's part. It was a closely related statute passed in the same legislative session in the same tort reform push, and they should be read in light of one of each other as that closely related. And if the legislature in one statute said or demanded dismissal for noncompliance but was silent on the statute that was, I believe, there may have been one bill in between. They were so very close. That can't be overlooked. And that omission should be viewed as intentional. I have nothing further to add, Your Honor.
I think that's it. Thank you both for your arguments. Very helpful. We'll stand in recess. I think that is the last argument for the day.
Thank you, and have a nice day.
Thank you, Your Honor.